This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
It's only temporary, she said, pushing the hair off her forehead. As soon as it's safe to get back to Earth, we'll... Hey, Cinder, are you watching the net? Thorn crowded into the doorway, outlined by the energy-saving lights in the hallway. What is this? Nap time? Turn some lights on. Cinder's muscles knotted across her shoulders. Can't you see I'm busy? Thorn surveyed the small dark room. Yeah, good one. Throwing her feet off the bed, Cinder sat up. I'm trying to concentrate. Well, keep up the good work, mate. In the meantime, you should come watch this. They're talking about us on all the channels. We're famous. No, thank you. I'd rather not see myself acting like a maniac at the most important social event of the year. She'd only watched the footage from the ball once, of when she'd lost her foot and crashed down the stairs, landing in a heap of wrinkled silk and muddied gloves, and that one viewing had been plenty. Thorn waved his hand. They already showed the clips. Ah, now you've achieved the dream of every red-blooded girl under the age of 25. Right. My life is a real dream come true. Thorn wiggled his eyebrow. Maybe not, but at least dreamy Prince Kai knows your name. Emperor Kai, she said, frowning at him. Precisely. Thorn cocked his head toward the front of the ship. They're starting a press conference to talk about you. Thought you wouldn't want to miss. Thorn fanned himself, swooning, his heavenly chocolate brown eyes and perfectly tousled hair, and Cinder sprang off the bed, shoving Thorn into the doorframe as she marched past him. Ow, he said, rubbing his arm. What's got your wires crossed? I'm adjusting that channel now. Iko's voice followed Cinder through the cargo bay and into the cockpit, where the main screen was showing Emperor Kai at a podium before an audience of journalists. The conference is just starting, and he looks so handsome today. Thanks, Iko, said Cinder, claiming the pilot's seat. Hey, that's my... She silenced Thorn with a wave and adjusted the screen's volume. Thing we can find the escaped convicts, Kai was saying. The circles beneath his eyes suggested that it had been a long time since he'd experienced a proper night's rest. Nevertheless, seeing him made Cinder both warm with longing and miserable when she thought of the last few moments she'd seen him, her having just tripped on the garden steps and lying sprawled on the gravel pathway with her wires sparking out of her ankle. He, disgusted, baffled, disappointed, betrayed. We've deployed our fastest ships with the most advanced search technology and the best pilots in order to track down the fugitives. They've been lucky in their evasion of us so far, but we don't expect that luck to last. The class of ship they're inhabiting is not meant for extended periods of orbit. Eventually, they will have to return to Earth, and we'll be ready for them. What kind of ship are they on? Asked a lady in the front row. Kai checked his notes. It's a stolen military cargo ship from the American Republic, a 214 Rampion, class 11.3. Its tracking devices have been stripped, which is largely responsible for the difficulties we've had in apprehending them. Thorn proudly poked Cinder in the back. On the screen, Kai nodded at another journalist near the back. You said our military would be waiting for them when they return to Earth. How long do you suspect that to be? And are you abandoning the space search in the meantime? Absolutely not. Our primary objective is to find them as soon as possible, and we plan to continue the search in space until they're found. However, my experts project the ship will be returning to Earth any time from 2 days to 2 weeks, depending on their fuel and power reserves, and we will be prepared for that return if necessary. Yes? My sources have told me that this cyborg, this Lynn Cinder, that's you, Thorn whispered with another jab. She batted him away. Was given a VIP invitation to the annual ball and was, in fact, an invited guest of yours, Your Majesty. Do you refute that claim? A what? Thorn asked. VIP invitation? Said Eco. Cinder scrunched up her shoulders, ignoring them both. On the screen, Kai shifted back from the podium, arms fully extended as if to give himself space to breathe before clearing his throat and nearing the mic again. I do not refute the claim. I met Lynn Cinder 2 weeks prior to the ball. As many of you know, she was a renowned mechanic here in the city, and I had hired her to fix a malfunctioning android. And yes, I did invite her to the ball as a personal guest.
What?
Cinder flinched from the shriek that pierced through the cockpit's speakers.
When did this happen? It better have happened after Andre dismantled me, because if he asked you to the ball and you didn't tell me...
Eco, I'm trying to listen. Cinder squirmed in her seat. Kai had asked her to the ball before Eco's body had been taken apart and sold off. Cinder had had the chance to tell her, but at the time she'd been determined not to accept the invitation, so it hadn't seemed that important. When Kai called on another journalist, Cinder realized she'd missed an entire question.
Did you know that she was a cyborg? Asked a woman in an unhidden tone of disgust.
Kai stared at her, appearing confused, then let his gaze dance over the crowd. He shuffled his feet closer to the podium, a wrinkle forming on the bridge of his nose. Cinder bit the inside of her cheek and braced herself for adamant disgust. Who would ever invite a cyborg to the ball? But instead, Kai said simply, I don't see that her being cyborg is relevant. Next question? Cinder's metal fingers jolted. Your Majesty, did you know that she was lunar when you extended this invitation? Looking like he might keel over from exhaustion, Kai shook his head. No, of course not. I, naively it seems, was under the impression that there were no lunars in the Commonwealth, other than our diplomatic guest here at the palace. Of course, now that it's been brought to my attention how easy it is for them to blend in with the populace, we will be taking additional security measures to both keep lunars from emigrating here, as well as to find and export any that might be within our borders. I have every intention to comply with the statutes of the Interplanetary Agreement of 54TE on this matter. Yes, second row. Regarding Her Majesty, Queen Lavanna, has she or any of the Lunar Court commented on the escape of the convict? Kai's jaw tensed. Oh, she's had a thing or two to say about it. Behind Kai, a government official cleared his throat. The irritation quickly evaporated from Kai's face, replaced with tactful vacancy. Queen Lavanna wants Lynn Cinder to be found, he amended, and brought to justice. Your Majesty, do you think these events may have harmed the diplomatic proceedings between Earth and Luna? I don't think they helped. Your Majesty, a man stood 3 rows back. Witness accounts from the ball seem to indicate that Lynn Cinder's arrest was part of an agreement between yourself and the Queen, and that letting her go could be cause for war. Is there reason to believe the cyborg's escape could lead to a greater threat to our national security? Kai moved to scratch behind his ear, but caught the nervous tick and placed his hand back on the podium. The word war has been thrown around between Earth and Luna for generations. It is my prerogative, as it was always my father's, to avoid that at all costs. I assure you I am doing everything in my power not to further unravel our fragile relationship with Luna, starting with finding Lynn Cinder. That's all. Thank you. He stepped off the stage to a wave of unanswered questions and was pulled into a whispered conversation with a group of officials. Pouting, Thorn slumped into the co-pilot's seat. He didn't mention me. Not once. Me neither, said Eco, without pity. You're not an escaped convict.
True, but His Majesty and I met once at the market. I felt like we had a really strong connection.
Didn't you think so, Cinder? The words slipped meaninglessly through Cinder's audio interface. She didn't respond, unable to tear her focus away from Kai. He was being forced to take responsibility for her actions. He was being unfairly faced with the repercussions of her decisions. In the aftermath of her escape, he alone had to deal with Queen Lavanna. Shutting her eyes against the sight of him, she rubbed her throbbing temple. "But I'm a wanted fugitive like Cinder," Thorn continued. "They do realize I'm missing, don't they?" "Maybe they're grateful," Cinder muttered. Thorn grumbled something incoherent, followed by a long silence during which Cinder massaged her brow and tried to convince herself she'd done the right thing. Spinning, Thorn kicked his feet onto the armrest of Cinder's chair, nudging her elbow off it. "Now I understand why you've been so immune to my charms. I had no idea I was competing with an emperor. That's a tough hand to beat, even for me." She snorted. "Don't be ridiculous. I hardly know him, and now he despises me." Thorn laughed, hooking his thumbs behind his belt loops. "I have great instincts when it comes to Amore, and he does not despise you. Plus, he asked a cyborg to the ball? That takes guts. I generally dislike royalty and government officials on principle, but I have to give him credit for that." Standing, Cinder shoved Thorn's feet off her chair, freeing her path to the door. "He didn't know I was cyborg." Thorn tilted his head as she passed. "He didn't?" "Of course not," she said, marching out of the small cockpit. "But he knows you're cyborg now, and he still likes you." She spun back to him, pointing toward the screen. "You got that from a 10-minute conference in which he said he's doing everything in his power to hunt me down and turn me over for execution?" Thorn smirked in a terrible, snotty voice that Cinder guessed was meant to be a Kai impersonation. He said, "I don't see that her being cyborg is relevant." Rolling her eyes, Cinder spun away. "Hey, come back!" Thorn's boots hit the ground behind her. "I have something else to show you. I'm busy. I promise not to make fun of your boyfriend anymore." "He's not my boyfriend. It's about Michel Benoit." Cinder sucked down a slow breath and turned back around. "What?" Thorn hesitated, as if afraid to move in case he set her off again, before inclining his head toward the cockpit stash behind him. "Come, take a look at this." Heaving a sigh, Cinder trudged back toward him. She settled her elbows on the back of Thorn's chair. Thorn dismissed the news channel. "Did you know that Michel Benoit has a teenage granddaughter?" "No," said Cinder, bored. "Well, she does. Miss Scarlet Benoit. Supposedly she'd just turned 18, but brace yourself. She doesn't have any hospital records. Get it? Holy spades, I'm a genius." Cinder scowled. "I don't get it." Tilting back, Thorn peered at her upside down. "She doesn't have any hospital records." "So?" He spun the chair to face her. "Do you know a single person who wasn't born in a hospital?" Cinder considered. "Are you suggesting she could be the princess?" "That's precisely what I'm suggesting." The net screen turned to a profile and picture of Scarlet Benoit. She was pretty, with pronounced curves and fiery red curls. Cinder squinted at the image. A teenage birth without a birth record. A ward of Michel Benoit. How convenient. "Well then, excellent detective work, Captain." Chapter 25. Scarlet dreamt that a blizzard had covered all of Europe in neck-deep snow. A child again, she came downstairs to find her grandmother kneeling in front of the wood stove. "I thought I'd found someone who would take you in," her grandmother said. "But they'll never come for you in all this snow. I guess I'll have to wait until spring now to get rid of you." She stoked the fire. The sparks flew into Scarlet's eyes, stinging, and she woke up with wetness on her cheeks, her fingers like ice. For a long time, she couldn't sort out what was a dream and what was a memory. Snow, but not so much snow. Her grandmother wanting to send her away, but not when she was a child, a teenager, 13. Had it been January, or later still in the winter, She struggled to piece together thawing memories. She'd been sent out to milk the cow, a chore she despised, and her hands were so numb she was afraid she would squeeze the udders too tight. Why hadn't she been in school that day? Was it a weekend? A vacation? Oh, right. She'd been visiting her father, just come back the day before. She was supposed to stay with him for a full month, but she couldn't stand it. The drinking, the coming back to the apartment in the middle of the night. Scarlett had taken the train home without telling anyone, surprising her grandmother with her arrival. Rather than happy to see her, her grandmother had been angry that Scarlett hadn't come to tell her what was happening. They'd had a fight. Scarlett was still mad at her, milking the cow, fingers freezing. It was the last time she'd ridden the maglev, the last time she'd seen her father. She remembered hurrying through her chores, desperate to be finished with them so she could go inside and get warm. It wasn't until she was rushing back to the house that she saw the hover out front. She'd seen plenty hovers when she lived in the city, but they were rare out in the country, where the farmers preferred larger, faster ships. She sneaked in through the back door and heard her grandmother in the kitchen, and a man, their voices muffled. She inched her way around the staircase, her feet silent on the terracotta tiles. "I can't imagine what a burden she'd been for you all these years," said the man in an eastern accent. Scarlett frowned, sensing the kitchen's warmth upon her cheeks as she peered through the cracked door. He was at the table, a mug in his hands. He had silk black hair and a long face. Scarlett had never seen him before. "She hasn't been as much trouble as I expected her to be," said her grandmother, who she couldn't see. "I've almost grown attached to her after all these years. But I must say, I'll be glad when she's gone. No more panicking each time an unfamiliar ship flies by." Scarlett's throat constricted. "You said she'd be ready to go in a week's time. Can that be so?" "Logan seems to think so. The device of yours is all we were waiting for. If the procedure goes smoothly, it could even be sooner. But you'll have to be patient with her. She'll be quite weak and more than a little bewildered." "Understandably so. I can't imagine what this must be like for her." Scarlett clamped a palm over her mouth to smother her breathing. "You have accommodation set up?" "Yes, we're quite prepared. It will take some getting used to for us as well. But I'm sure it will all work out once she's settled in. I have two girls of my own about her age, 12 and 9. I'm sure they'll adore each other, and I will treat her as if she were my own." "What about Madam Lynn? Is she prepared?" "Prepared?" The man chuckled, but the sound was rough and uncomfortable. "She could not have been more astounded when I brought up the idea of adopting a third girl. But she's a good mother. I'm sorry she wasn't able to come with me, but I wanted to draw as little attention to this trip as possible. Of course she doesn't know about the girl." "Not everything." Scarlett must have made a sound because the man suddenly looked up and saw her. He stiffened. Her grandmother's chair scratched against the floor, and the door swung open. She was furious. Scarlett was furious right back at her. "Scarlett, you know better than to eavesdrop. Go to your room." She wanted to scream, to stomp, to tell her that she couldn't just send her away like she was nothing. Not again. But the words wouldn't come. They were choked off at the base of her tongue. So she did as she was told, her feet pounding up the stairs and into her room before her grandma could see the tears. It wasn't only realizing that she wasn't wanted, or that she could be passed off to any stranger that came for her. It was that, after 6 long years, she'd just begun to feel like she belonged, like maybe her grandma loved her more than her mother had, more than her father, like maybe the two of them were a team. After that morning, she lived in fear for a week, 2 weeks, a month. But the man never came for her, and she and her grandmother never spoke of it again. "Scarlett?" The tightening of Wolf's arm around her waist dragged Scarlet back into the present, into a train car that was slowing down around her. She was curled up like a child, with her back against him, and though her eyes were squeezed shut, a few hot tears had escaped, rolled over the bridge of her nose, dripped across her temples. She hastily brushed them away. Wolf stirred and propped himself up behind her. "Scarlet?" His tone was nervous. "I had a bad dream," she said, not wanting him to think the tears had anything to do with him. Already they were stopping, and she rolled onto her back. It must have still been night for the darkness that took up the train car, but the unnatural glimmer of city neon targeted the crates just inside the door, sending splashes of pink and green over the stacked boxes. "I remembered something," she whispered. "I think it might have to do with the princess." He tensed. "I remember my grandma mentioning Logan now, but she didn't want me to overhear. I was eavesdropping, and there was another man." She told him the story as well as she could, piecing the memory back together as her brain threatened to fog over. When she was done, she lay still, listening to the whistle of wind outside the train cars. Her side was stiff from sleeping on the hard crate. Rather than look relieved or hopeful, Wolf peered down at her, terrified. "That's what they're looking for, isn't it? I mean, it must have been the princess they were talking about. I don't know where she was, who was taking care of her. I never saw her. All this time I thought she'd been planning on sending me away. But now, after what you told me about Logan Tanner and Grandmare and Princess Selene..." Wolf pulled away from her, sitting up and curling his knees against his chest. He stared blankly at the stacks of crates surrounding them. "This man had an accent. I think he was from the Eastern Commonwealth." Scarlet pushed herself up beside him, combing her hair to one side. "And I'm pretty sure my grandma called his wife Madame Lin. I don't know how common a name it is, but I would recognize him if I saw him again. I'm sure I would." "Don't say that." Wolf pressed his hands over his ears. "I didn't hear that." Scarlet blinked, stunned by his grimace. "Wolf?" Reaching forward, she tugged his hands down. "This is good, isn't it? They want information. I have information. We'll barter. We'll trade for my grandmother's safety. Isn't that..." "Don't go." His gaze trapped her in the darkness. Tasseled hair, faint scars, flecks of sleep in his eyelashes. Wolf twisted a curl of her hair around his fingers. "Don't go looking for your grandmother." A streak of orange light flashed through the door and vanished. "I have to." "No, Scarlet, you don't have to." He grasped her hand, engulfing it in both of his. "There's nothing you can do for her. If you go, you'll only be putting yourself in danger. Would your grandmother want that?" Scarlet yanked her hand out of Wolf's grip. "We can run away," he continued, his fingers scrambling for contact, knotting themselves around her pockets. "We'll disappear in the forest. Go to Africa or the Commonwealth. We can survive, and they'll never find us. I can keep you safe, Scarlet. I can protect you." "What are you talking about? Just last night you said that if I had any information, it could help. It could be my grandma's only chance, and now I have information. I thought that's what you wanted." "Maybe," he said. "Maybe if you had a full name, an address, something specific. But a last name and a country, an enormous country, and a description? Scarlet, if you tell them this, they'll only take you captive in hopes that you'll be able to identify this man." Tugging at her zipper, she studied him, how his eyes were more crazed with every breath he took. "Good," she said. "Then we'll offer to trade me for my grandmother." He shrank back, shaking his head, but Scarlet was bolstered. "We'll go together. You can tell them that you have information, but you'll only give it to them on the condition that they let you walk away free and that you take my grandmother with you. They can have me." Wolf shuddered.
Wolf, you have to promise me you'll take care of her. We don't know what kind of condition she'll be in. If she's hurt, you'll have to take care of her. Her voice hitched, but there were no more tears. Her resolve was complete until, what if she's already dead, Scarlet? Dread settled in her stomach at the words she refused to speak, for fear it could make them real. The train was still slowing, and Scarlet could make out the furious noise of the city, hovers and net screens and buzzers warning to stay off the tracks. It was the middle of the night, but in the city there was never silence. Do you think she is? Her voice trembled. Her heart throbbed as she waited for him to answer. Do you think they've killed her? Every moment wrapped around Scarlet's neck, strangling her, until the only possible word from Wolf's lips had to be yes. Yes, she was dead. Yes, she was gone. They'd murdered her. These monsters had murdered her. Scarlet pressed her palms into the crate, trying to push through the plastic. Say it. No, he murmured, shoulders sinking. No, I don't think they've killed her. Not yet. Scarlet shivered with relief. She covered her face with both hands, dizzy with the hurricane of emotions. Thanks the stars, she whispered. Thank you. His tone hardened. Don't thank me for telling the truth when it would have been a mercy to lie to you.
Mercy? You tell me she's dead? To break my heart?
Making you believe she was dead was the only chance I had to convince you not to go looking for her. We both know that. I should have lied. The hum of the tracks deepened as the train crawled into a station. Voices yelled. Machinery clanked and hissed.
It's not your decision to make, she said, grabbing the port screen and checking their location. They've made it to Paris. I have to go after her. But you don't have to come with me.
Scarlet?
No, listen. I appreciate your help, how far you've brought me. But I can go on alone. Just tell me where to go, and I'll find it myself.
Maybe I won't. Scarlet shoved the port into her pocket, anger burning in her cheeks. Then she met Wolf's gaze and saw, not stubbornness, but panic, his fingers curling and uncurling again and again. She released her mounting resentment. Scooting toward Wolf, she cupped his face in her hands. He flinched but didn't pull away.
They'll want this information, won't they? His expression was stone. Will offer me as a trade. You and Grandmère can go somewhere safe, take care of each other, and when they let me go, I'll come and find you. They can't keep me forever.
She smiled as warmly as she could and waited for him to return it. When he didn't, she rubbed her thumbs across his cheeks and kissed him. Though he instantly pulled her against him, he didn't let the kiss linger.
There's no guarantee they'll let you go. When they're done with you, they might kill you. You're sacrificing your life for hers.
It's a chance I have to take. The train came to a steady stop and sank down onto the tracks. Wolf's eyes saddened.
I know. You'll do what you have to do.
Peeling her hands off his shoulders, he placed a sweet kiss against her wrist, where the blood pulsed beneath her skin. And so will I.
Chapter 26. The underground platform was well lit and filled with androids and hovering carts ready to unload the train's cargo. Scarlet followed Wolf into the shadows of another freight train. They waited until an android turned away before crawling up onto the platform. Wolf grabbed her wrist and pulled her across the platform, ducking behind a cart loaded with crates. A moment later, Scarlet saw an android roll into the car she and Wolf had just abandoned, its blue light seeping back out the door. "Be ready to run when that train leaves," Wolf said, adjusting the bag on his shoulder. Not seconds later, the train lifted up off the tracks and began gliding back into the tunnel. Scarlet sprang toward the tracks, only to find herself being pulled back by her hood. She let out a strangled cry and slammed back into Wolf.
What?
He placed a finger to his mouth. Scarlet glared and ripped her hood from his grasp, but then she heard it too, the hum of an approaching train. It was on the third track out and blew past them without any indication of slowing, vanishing into the darkness again as quickly as it had come. Wolf grinned. Now we can go. They reached the other platform without any further run-ins, spotted only by a middle-aged man who watched them curiously over his port. Scarlet checked her own port when they reached street level. The city was quiet in the still of morning. They were at the Gare de Lyon, surrounded by avenues of shops and offices. Though Wolf tried to hide it, Scarlet could tell he was sniffing for something. All she could smell was city, metal and asphalt, and baking bread from a closed patisserie on the corner. Wolf headed northwest. The street was lined with imposing second-era Beaux-Arts structures and flower boxes hanging from stone-wrapped windows. An ornate clock tower stood in the distance, its face lit up and showing two broad, pointed hands and Roman numerals. Below it stood a digital screen that read 0426 beside an ad for the newest model of House Android. "How far are we?" Scarlet asked. "Not far. We can walk." They turned left at a traffic circle, Wolf half a step ahead of her, hunched over like he was barricading himself. Scarlet's gaze traveled down his arm, over the bandage wound that no longer seemed to be bothering him, to his fidgeting fingers. She wanted to reach out to him, but found it impossible. She tucked both of her hands into her hoodie's pockets instead. There was an abyss opening up between them, cutting through whatever they'd shared on the train. They were almost there, almost to her grandmother, almost to the Order of the Pack. Maybe he was leading her to her death. Maybe Wolf was marching toward his. She tilted her chin up, refusing to frighten herself with her own morose thoughts. All that mattered now was rescuing her grandmother, and she was so close, so close. The ancient residences drew in closer to the road as they left the busy intersection behind. There was only the occasional sign of life, a cat cleaning itself in the window of a hat shop, a man in a suit darting from a hotel into a waiting hover. They passed a net screen that showed a commercial for a shampoo that claimed to change the color of one's hair based on their moods. She already yearned for the solitude of the farm. That was the only reality she knew, the farm and her grandmother and her weekly deliveries. And now Wolf, that was the reality she wanted. Wolf quickened his pace, but his shoulders were squeezing inward again. Locking her jaw, Scarlet reached forward and grasped his wrist. "I can't let you do this," she said, angrier than she'd intended. "Just tell me where it is, and I'll go on by myself. Just tell me what to do. Give me some indication of what I'm dealing with, and I'll figure something out. But I can't let you go with me." He stared down at her for a long moment, and she tried to see softness in his stark green eyes, but the warmth and desperation that had been so apparent on the train were now replaced with a cold resolve. He pried his arm away. "Do you see the man sitting in front of the closed cafe on the other side of the street?" She slid her attention off him and found the man sitting at one of the outdoor tables. One ankle was propped on his knee, his elbow dangling off the back of his chair. He was staring at them, and he didn't try to hide it. When Scarlet caught his eye, he winked. A chill crawled over her skin. "Pack member," said Wolf. "We passed another at the Magrail station two blocks back. And," he craned his head, "if the stench is any indication, we're about to cross paths with another when we turn this next corner." Her heart was suddenly stomping. "How did they know we were here?" "I suspect they've been waiting for us. They've probably been tracking your ID." "That's what people did when they ran away and didn't want to be found. They cut out their ID chips." "Or yours," she murmured. "If they do have access to an ID tracker, then maybe they've been following you." "Maybe." His voice was nonchalant, and she realized this wasn't news to him. Had he thought this could be possible? Was that how Rand had found them? We might as well go find out what they want. Wolf turned away, and she had to race to keep up with him.
But there's only three of them. You can fight three of them, can't you? You said you could take...
She hesitated. Wolf had told her he would win in a fight against six wolves. When had those wild animals become synonymous with these men, this order of the pack?
You could still get away. There's still a chance, she finished.
I said I would protect you, and that's what I'm going to do. It's pointless to discuss this any further.
I don't need your protection.
Yes, he said, the word biting over the synthesized noise of a music video on a nearby billboard. Yes, you do. Scarlet darted in front of him, planting her feet. He stopped just shy of plowing into her.
No, she said. What I need is to know that I'm not responsible for whatever they'll do to you. You need to stop being stupid and get out of here. At least give yourself a chance.
He peered over her head at some place in the distance. Scarlet tensed, wondering if he'd picked up on the presence of a fourth pack member or even more. Gulping, she glanced at the man by the cafe, who was stroking his ear and watching them with obvious amusement.
What's stupid is not that I'm going to try to protect you, Wolf said, pulling his focus back down to her. What's stupid is that I almost believe it will make a difference.
He stepped around her, shrugging off the hand that reached out to stop him. Her thoughts teetered, knowing she had a choice. She could run away with him, leave the city, and never come back. She could choose not to go in search of her grandmother after all, and maybe save his life. But it was not really a choice. She barely knew him. Despite the ache in her heart, despite everything, she would never be able to live with herself, knowing that she'd abandoned her grandmother when she was this close. She turned back only once as they were rounding a corner and saw that the man by the cafe was gone. A block later, the memory of the Fourth World War caught up to them all at once, the scorch marks and crumbling facades of a city pummeled by war. There weren't enough of the beautiful old buildings left to draw the interest of the conservationists, and the sheer amount of destruction must have been too overwhelming for reconstruction. Unable to demolish the city's history, the government had left this quarter alone. The districts, though separated by only a few streets, seemed worlds apart. With a gasp, Scarlet recognized the massive building stretching along the opposite side of the street, with its shattered arched windows and the statues of men in old-fashioned clothing, many with broken limbs and some alcoves missing their statues altogether. The Musée du Louvre, one of the few sites her father had taken her to as a child, the building half-collapsed on the west end, was too unstable to go inside, but she and her father had stood together on the sidewalk while he told her about the priceless artworks that had been destroyed in the bombings, or the lucky few that had become spoils of war. Many had still not been found, over a century later. It was one of the few pleasant memories she had of her father, and she'd forgotten it until now. Scarlet, she snapped her head around. This way. Wolf angled his head toward another street. She nodded and followed him without looking back. Despite the district's tarnish, it was clear that these ancient streets weren't entirely abandoned. A small motel advertised, "Come stay the night with the ghost of fallen civilians," in the window. A thrift store displayed headless mannequins garbed in a rush of vibrant fabrics. At an intersection, Wolf paused on a concrete city square with a boarded-up entrance to the subway and a sign that indicated the platform was closed. The nearest could be found on the Boulevard des Italiens. "Are you ready?" She followed his transfixed gaze up to a towering, gorgeous building before them. Angels and cherubim stood guard at massive arched doorways. "What is this?" Wolf followed her gaze. Once it was an opera house, and an architectural marvel. Then the war came, and it was converted into storage for artillery and eventually prisoners of war. Then, when no one else wanted it, we took over. Scarlet frowned at that word, we. Seems a little conspicuous for a secret street gang, don't you think? Would you ever suspect something horrible was living inside? When she didn't answer, he backed away, scrutinizing her as he approached the massive theater. Again he asked, are you ready? Catching her breath, she examined the carvings, faces grim and beautiful, the chalky busts of men staring down at her, a long balcony missing half its balusters. Clenching her jaw, she crossed the street and marched up the steps that spanned the length of the building, past the silent, unpreserved angels, beneath the shadowed portico. I'm ready, she said, eyeing the mess of graffiti across the doors. Scarlet, she turned to face him, surprised by the gruffness in his voice. I'm sorry. He was careful not to touch her as he passed. Her mouth went dry, warnings cluttering her head as Wolf pulled the nearest door open and stepped into the shadows. Chapter 27. The door thudded shut behind them. Scarlet found herself in the immense foyer of the opera house, almost pitch black, but for warm, flickering candlelight beyond the arches. The lobby was full of silence and dust and chunks of broken marble along the floor. The dust clogged Scarlet's throat, and she struggled not to cough as she moved toward the light. Her footsteps were shockingly loud in the empty, hollow building as she passed between two massive columns. She gasped. The light was coming from one of two statues that flanked a grand double staircase. It depicted two women draped in billowing fabric atop a pedestal, each holding aloft a bouquet of torches. Dozens of wax candles glowed and flickered, casting a haunting orange film over the lobby. The staircase, carved from red and white marble, was missing random balustrades, and a companion statue to the first was missing her head and the arm that once held her own candelabra. Scarlet's foot splashed into a puddle, and she drew back, first looking down at the broken marble floor, then up. Three stories of balconies rose above, and in their center, where the light barely reached, was a painted ceiling with a square window in its center. The window, it seemed, had long been missing. Hugging herself, Scarlet turned back to Wolf. He lingered between the columns. Maybe they're sleeping, she said, attempting nonchalance. Wolf peeled himself out of the shadows and prowled toward the staircase. His body was as tense as the statues that watched them. Scarlet's gaze darted over the railings above, but she saw no movement, no sign of life, no garbage, no smell of food, no sound of talking or net screens. Even the sounds of the street had disappeared beyond the massive entry doors. She clenched her jaw, anger flaring up inside her at the sickening sensation of being trapped like a mouse to be preyed upon. Stomping past Wolf, she marched toward the stairs until her toes pressed against the first riser. Hello? She yelled, craning her head. You have visitors! Her words echoed back to her, harsh and defiant. No sound, no alarm. Then from the silence a familiar chime. Scarlet jumped at the sound that echoed between the marble pillars, despite being muffled within her pocket. Heart racing, she pulled out the port screen just as the computerized voice began to speak. Com received from Mademoiselle Scarlet Benoit from L'Hôpital Joseph Ducouin in Toulouse. Scarlet blinked. A hospital? Handshaking, she pulled up the com. 30 of August, 126 T.E. This communication is to inform Scarlet Benoit of Réau France E.F. that at 5:09 on 30th of August, 126, Luc Raoul Benoit of Paris, France E.F. was pronounced dead by on-staff medical practitioner, ID number 58279. Presumed cause of death,
alcohol poisoning. Please respond within 24 hours if you would like an autopsy to be performed for the cost of 4,500 univs. With sympathies, the staff of L'Hôpital Joseph Ducouing, Toulouse. Confusion reigned, her heart thumping erratically. The message didn't want to compute, her brain turning it over and over. She pictured him the last time she'd seen him, raving and tortured and afraid, how she screamed at him, told him she never wanted to see him again. How could he be dead only 24 hours later? Shouldn't she have received a calm when he'd been admitted into the hospital? Shouldn't there have been a warning? Swaying on her feet, she peered up at Wolf. My dad's dead, she said, her whisper barely filling the enormous space. Alcohol poisoning. His jaw flexed. Are they sure about that? His suspicion was slow to filter through her enrenching numbness. You think they sent the comm by mistake? A touch of sympathy flickered in his eyes. No, Scarlet, but I do think he was in danger of something much worse than a fondness for drinking. She didn't understand. He'd been tortured, but the burn marks wouldn't have killed him. The insanity wouldn't have killed him. Through the fog in her brain, a gentle, caressing instinct told her to look up. So she did. Behind Wolf, framed by two pillars that held unlit sconces, was a man. He was willowy and lean, with wavy dark hair and near-black eyes that burned in the candlelight. He would have had a pleasant smile if Scarlet hadn't been so startled by his presence, his silence. The fact that Wolf did not seem surprised he was there, did not even bother to face him, though he undoubtedly felt him too. More terrifying than all that was his clothing. He wore a crimson-red coat that flared at the waist and had long, bell-shaped sleeves. Gold-embroidered runes sparkled along the hems. It was almost like a child's costume, an imitation of the horrible lunar court. Fear thumped against Scarlet's ribcage. This was not a costume. This was the stuff of nightmares and horror stories told to keep children from misbehaving. A thaumaturge. A lunar thaumaturge. Hello, the man said in a voice as sweet and smooth as melted caramel. You must be Mademoiselle Benoit. She stumbled back onto the first step, catching the rail for balance. In front of her, Wolf dipped his eyes and turned around. The man acknowledged him with a polite nod. Alpha Kelsey, so glad you made it back safely. And if I am to correctly understand the calm the lady just received, Beta Wynn's task in Toulouse must be finished as well. It seems we will soon be a full pack again. Wolf clamped a fist to his chest and gave a slight bow. I am glad to hear it, Master Jael. Gulping, Scarlet pushed her hip into the rail. No, she said, finding her voice on the second try. He brought me here to find my grandmother. He's not one of you anymore. The man's smile was warm and understanding. I see. I'm sure you are quite eager to see your grandmother. I hope to reunite you shortly. Scarlet clenched her fists. Where is she? If you've hurt her, she's quite alive, I assure you, said the man. Without any change in expression, he slid his attention back to Wolf. Tell me, Alpha, were you able to meet your objectives? Wolf lowered his hand to his side. Obedience hung from him like a thin, absurd disguise. A headache pounded at Scarlet's temples. Her nerves hummed as she waited, hoping and wishing he was going to tell this man that he'd left their ridiculous pack and he was never coming back. But the hope couldn't be entertained for long. It was being shucked off before Wolf even opened his mouth. This man was not a rebellious criminal, some member of a vigilante gang. If he was truly a thaumaturge, a real thaumaturge standing before her, then he worked for the Lunar Crown. And Wolf, what did that make Wolf? I have questioned her to the best of my ability, Wolf said. She has a single vague memory but I doubt both its usefulness and its reliability. Time and stress seem to have had an effect on her recollections, and at this point I have no doubt she would create falsehoods if she believed they would benefit her grandmother. The thaumaturge tilted his chin up, considering him. Alfred Kelsey. Scarlet's heart hammered against her collarbone, ready to choke her. I have questioned her to the best of my ability. Wolf? He did not turn to her, did not flinch or sigh or respond. He was a statue. He was a pawn. The thaumaturge made a sad sound. No matter. Then, after a silence in which Scarlet felt the stairs crumbling beneath her, he said, Omega Kelsey was to inform you that our objectives have changed. Her Majesty is no longer concerned with identifying Selene. Wolf's fingers twitched. Nevertheless, it has become clear to me that Madame Benoit has not yet given up all her secrets. Perhaps we can find another use for the Mademoiselle. Wolf's chin lifted just slightly. If she had any additional information, she would have told me. I am sure her trust was complete. Scarlet half slumped onto the marble rail, grasping the base of the headless statue to keep from sinking to the ground. I'm sure you have done well, said the thaumaturge. Don't be alarmed. I will see that your efforts are given proper recognition. Who's Beta Wynn? Said Scarlet. What was his task in Toulouse? Her voice was weak, filled with disbelief as she teetered on the stairs. She struggled to believe this was all a nightmare. Soon she would wake up on the train, in Wolf's arms, and this would all happen very differently. But she did not wake up, and the thaumaturge was eyeing her with dark, sympathetic eyes. Beta Wynn's task was to kill your father in a manner that would not raise suspicions, he said with no reservations than if he were giving her the time of day. I did offer your father a chance. If he had found something useful on Madame Benoit's property, I think I truly would have considered letting him live, perhaps kept him as a slave. But he failed in the time we gave him, so I was forced to have him silenced. He knew too much about us, you see, and he had served his usefulness. I'm afraid we have little tolerance for useless earthlings. He grinned, the look twisting Scarlet's gut, not because it was a cruel smile, but because it was a kind one. You appear to be ill, Mademoiselle. Perhaps you will need some rest before you're fit to see your grandmother. Rafe, Troya, won't you see the lady to her prepared room? They emerged from the shadows, two men who were nothing but blurs in Scarlet's consciousness. They lifted her by her elbows, not bothering with ties or cuffs. Her mind flashed, and before she knew it, she was reaching for her waistband.